Now in the middle of a series of studies in the Gospel of John, and we continue those this morning in chapter 13 of John's Gospel. I'm going to read the first 17 verses. It was just before the Passover feast. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. The evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Jesus replied, "You do not realize now what I am doing, but later you will understand." "No," said Peter, "you shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no part with me." Then Lord Simon Peter replied, "Not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well." Jesus answered, "A person who has had a bath needs only to wash his feet. His whole body is clean. And you are clean, though not every one of you." For he knew who was going to betray him, and that was why he said not everyone was clean. When he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. "Do you understand what I've done for you?" he asked them. "You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. I tell you the truth, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them." Now, the trouble with humility, of course, is that it's the one virtue you can't be proud of, isn't it? One recalls the title of a little book by Charles Spurgeon, "Humility and How I Achieved It." The irony is obviously deliberate, and it makes the point, well, humility can't be achieved. It's a very elusive quality. You can never obtain it by direct ambition, and even if you do obtain it, you can never really know you've got it. For once you observe it in your character, you immediately destroy it by self-congratulation, don't you? "There's no greater sign of confirmed pride," someone has said, "than when we think we're humble enough." This is the embarrassing dilemma of every perfectionist, of every Pharisee, of every self-righteous person. To the very extent they succeed in achieving their self-appointed moral goals, humility becomes less and less accessible to them. Maybe that's why, in many, perhaps even most cultures, humility is not really regarded as a virtue at all. Oh, I know the world does sometimes pay lip service to the desirability of a modest attitude, but if you think about it, in practice, it always reserves its real admiration for people who assert themselves, who demand their rights, who refuse to be walked over under any circumstances. It was just like that in Jesus' day, in the Hellenistic world. The cult of the hero was everywhere, immortalized in the mythology of Greece and Rome, idolized in the sculptures and statues that adorned every public square. The empires of the ancient world had been built out of a consuming ambition to win, to be boss, to come out on top, to be the master of the world. So whether you were a victorious general or a successful athlete or a brilliant orator or a great politician, whatever you were, greatness lay in the humiliation of your opponents. There was no honor in humility. In the Greco-Roman world, humility was not even thought of in any way whatsoever as a virtue. It was a vice, most definitely, a vice. Humility was a cowardly dog with its tail between its legs. Humility was to be a cringing, snivelling, servile nobody. So it's no wonder Jesus posed such an enigma for the people of his day, is it? No wonder that his claims seem so riddled with implausibility, because again and again he overturned their preconceived ideas in this regard. Blessed are the meek, he said. They shall inherit the earth. Again and again he tried to reinforce this lesson in his parables, like that one that was read earlier to us. Those who exalt themselves will be humbled, he said. Those who humble themselves will be exalted. His disciples had been as slow as everybody else to accept this revolutionary perspective. Many occasions we read there was rivalry between them, arguing about which of them was the most important. Like again that occasion we read earlier, when Jesus told them, if anybody wants to be first, he must be last, servant of all. And to illustrate the point, he put that child in the midst of them. Yet even in spite of explicit instruction like that, they never really took the point on board. Rivalry was among them continuing right up until the very last week of Jesus' life. In fact, Luke tells us that even as they were seated around the table at the Last Supper, this spirit of one-upmanship broke out again. They were arguing, a dispute arose, he tells us, about which of them was the greatest. And no doubt it's against that background that we are to understand this yet one more graphic demonstration of the humility, of the meekness, which Jesus insists must characterize those who want to belong to his kingdom. It's not difficult to picture the scene, is it? They've come quite a few miles, probably, on the road to Jerusalem, on those hot and dusty roads of Judea. Their feet have become uncomfortably soiled, as commonly happened. And it was a customary courtesy in such a situation to refresh a guest by washing their feet. But such a task would only be performed by a menial, by a servant. The host would never perform it. In this house, however, where Jesus and his friends are staying this last night before he is betrayed, there seem to be no servants available. No doubt we are to imagine the disciples casting their eye around the gathering, all privately wishing somebody would wash my feet because they're thoroughly uncomfortable, but all unwilling in this irritated mood of mutual rivalry that is among them to do the job themselves. So just imagine the shock in their eyes and the blush rising to their cheeks when the master himself gets up from the meal and performs this act of service which pride had prevented them from doing. There were any number of reasons why Jesus might not feel like washing his disciples' feet that particular night, after all. It was his last night of freedom, and he knew it. The time had come for him to leave the world, we read in verse 1. This cruel shadow of the cross that had haunted him was now very, very close. It would have been understandable if Jesus had been rather self-absorbed that night, looking to his disciples to minister to his needs, rather than vice versa. What's more, we're told the architect of his coming arrest was there with him at table. The devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot to betray Jesus, and verse 11, he knew who it was going to betray him. It must have been extraordinarily hurtful for Jesus, don't you think, to eat that fellowship meal, having one of his closest associates there, and knowing that person was plotting treachery under his very nose. Many in such circumstances would at least have given way to a little sullen resentment. But most poignant of all, Jesus, we're told here, no longer entertained the slightest self-doubt about his personal identity and his personal destiny. He was the Son of God, and he knew it, John tells us, verse 3. Jesus knew the Father had put all things under his power, that he'd come from God and was returning to God. What an astonishing sentence. It's almost inconceivable that anyone could seriously possess such an awareness of their own majesty and not display some trace of personal egoism in their behavior. He knew the vast dimensions of his supernatural authority, John tells us. The all things, the universe, were in his power. He knew the supreme glory of his divine origin and of his heavenly destiny. He had come from God and was returning to God. And yet there's not a hint of swaggering arrogance or snooty superiority. There's no withering glances, no standing on dignity. Instead, we read, he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, wrapped a towel around his waist, and after that he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. Do you notice how painstakingly John records each step Jesus takes? There's almost a photographic precision, like a slow motion camera. One gets the feeling this was a moment burnt on the apostle's memory in minute detail, frame by frame, and he wants us to capture the scene in our mind's eye with just the same vividness of impact and detail. In all the months they journeyed together, Jesus had never made this point about humility with quite such dramatic force. And he is not slow to drive it home, is he? You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that's what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. And yet, exquisite and moving demonstration of humility, though this foot washing is, I think you'll agree with me there is something else going on in this narrative as well. Look at those middle verses, between verse 6 to 10. Lord, are you going to wash my feet? Says Peter. You do not realize now what I am doing. Later you will understand. You'll never wash my feet. Unless I wash you, you have no part with me. In his typical way, John has overlaid this incident, as he's told it to us, with some additional level of meaning, a less obvious level of meaning, woven into the texture of his account. Jesus hints at that when he says, you do not realize now what I'm doing. There's something that goes beyond the immediate, an obvious lesson of humility here then. Something which the disciples didn't and couldn't comprehend right then. Something about washing and bathing and what it all symbolizes. What is in fact Jesus referring to then? What is this hidden significance underlying the foot washing? Now, any of you who have read any of the commentaries on this passage will be aware that one answer to that, with a very long tradition of interpretation behind it, is that Jesus is pointing forward here to the sacraments of the Christian church, to baptism and to Holy Communion in particular. The figure of washing with water, it said, would inevitably generate thoughts of Christian baptism to the minds of the early Christians for whom John is writing. And the fact that it's all happening on that last Passover night as the evening meal is being served inevitably invites associations in your mind with thoughts of Holy Communion. Now, I think it's very important to issue a caution about going too far down that particular line. I believe there's something in it, as we shall see. But it's not quite as straightforward as some have made out. The connection with baptism here would be a lot stronger, for instance, if John had actually used the word baptized somewhere in the text. As it is, it all hinges on the fact that Jesus is using water and talks about washing. But, I mean, if you're to read baptism every time that sort of thing happens, I suppose every time Jesus eats something or mentions the word bread, we're to read an allusion to the Lord's Supper. The reference to Holy Communion is a bit more persuasive because, clearly, it is the Last Supper they are sharing. John's readers at the end of the first century would be very familiar with the account of that Last Supper preserved for them in the tradition of the other Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, as well as, of course, the writings of Paul, who also talks about it. And without question, the liturgy of their corporate worship would include the breaking of bread, as it had done right from the beginning. So, I'm sure they would have been anticipating that John, at this point in his narrative, would proceed to give his account of the institution of Holy Communion, as every other one of the Gospel writers does. But of course, that is the point. The most conspicuous thing about church sacraments, as far as this passage is concerned, is their absence. John completely omits any reference to Holy Communion. Alone among the four Gospels, he refrains from mentioning the share bread and wine at all. There's not the slightest indication that these things are in his mind in this whole section. The incident of the foot washing, in effect, replaces the institution of Holy Communion in John's Gospel. So far from wanting to encourage a sacramentalist understanding of his words, I suggest to you it's at least arguable that John is deliberately trying to play down the importance of sacraments to his first century readers. And one wonders whether already, by the end of the first century, some degree of superstition was attached to things like Holy Communion. We know it wasn't long before such superstitious thoughts about the Mass had become current in the Church. Was the act of the Church in its Eucharistic ritual, was that becoming more significant, more important in the minds of Christian believers in John's day, perhaps, than the act of God in Christ? quite possible, I think. And that being so, it's quite conceivable to me that John's intention here in presenting us with a quite different and a quite unexpected rite, foot washing, rather than the breaking of bread, he's trying to redirect our attention away from such sacramental signs altogether and back to the reality, the historical reality, which those signs are meant to signify. And what historical reality is that? Why, it is the cross, of course. It's the cross of Jesus. Unlike these rather forced sacramentalist overtones that some commentators try to identify, there are numerous hints in the text that the real thing that underlies this account of the foot washing is the coming dying of Jesus. There's that introductory comment, for instance, in verse 1. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. How in the Gospel of John, or indeed in the whole of the New Testament, is the love of Christ shown? John will tell us in his own words in just a little while. Greater love has no one than this, than that he lay down his life for his friends. For John, supremely, the cross is the very definition of what the word love means. He loved them to the very end, as we might translate it. This is a picture, then, of the grim and humiliating terminus of Jesus' life. A terminus he would go to willingly out of love for his own. And the foot washing is a kind of dramatic representation of that, an anticipation of that ultimatum of love, played out before the real thing. Or take those verbs in verse 4 and in verse 12. The verb to take off his clothes and to put on his clothes. Interestingly, those are the very words that are used back in chapter 10 of this gospel for Jesus is laying down his life and taking his life again. It could very well be a deliberate echo back those couple of chapters in those verbs. But for me, the most convincing argument of all is the parallels between this entire paragraph here and that passage from Philippians 2 that we read together earlier. Do you notice those parallels? Lots of scholars believe Paul, in that passage in Philippians 2, actually incorporates an early Christian hymn. And if so, I'm convinced myself it was a hymn that John and his readers were thoroughly familiar with. Because he's deliberately, surely, echoing the same sequence of thoughts. Jesus, who being in very nature God, begins Paul. Says John, Jesus knew the Father had put all things under his power, that he'd come from God and was returning to God. Jesus made himself nothing, taking the form of a servant, writes Paul. He got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, wrapped a towel around his waist. Here is his emptying, and he's taking the form of a servant. Being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself, writes Paul. He poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet, writes John. And what did that humbling consist of, according to Paul? What was its goal? What was its finale? Why? He became obedient unto death, even death on a cross. We are on much more solid ground than if we see behind the surface details of this incident. Not any intention to teach us about the sacraments per se, but rather a picture of the dying of Jesus and what it achieves for his people. If there is an allusion to baptism in this watery symbolism, it's there only because baptism also depicts the cleansing work of Christ, the Lamb whose blood was shed to wash away the sin of the world. And if there is a connection here with Holy Communion, it's there only because Holy Communion also points in the same direction, the direction of Calvary. I expect some of you know that, particularly in the Catholic tradition, there are numerous examples of the actual reenactment of this foot-washing ceremony in literal obedience to Jesus' command. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done. Benedictine monks, as part of their rule, wash one another's feet. The Pope ceremoniously washes the feet of selected individuals on Maundy Thursday, the so-called pedilavium. And Christian monarchs down through history have participated in similar gestures of self-abasement. Ironically, you know, I suspect the ritualism of that sort of practice has obscured the very point John was so anxious to make. Namely, that ritualism really is not what it's all about. It is always the danger, you see. We turn bread and wine, we turn foot washing, we turn baptism into some kind of rite and forget that of which it speaks. Ceremonies and rituals are not what God is looking for. David understood that many years ago when he said, "You do not desire sacrifice, or I would bring it. The sacrifice of God is a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart, O God, you will not despise." So it's that understanding of what's going on that we're going to bring to the passage. It's a great example to us of humility, but more than that, in addition to that, it's a great picture of where that humility of Christ was supremely displayed. On the cross, where he washed away our sins for us through his own death. With that in mind, then, I want you to learn three lessons with me this morning. First, a lesson about the nature of humility. Secondly, a lesson about the necessity of humility. And third, a lesson drawn from the model of humility itself which Jesus sets. First, a lesson about the nature of humility. The lesson I want you to learn is quite simply this. There is all the difference in the world between humility and an inferiority complex. Now, some of us, of course, suffer from inferiority complexes, don't we? It's very easy to kid yourself, you know, when you're one of those people, that you're being humble. You're being nothing of the sort. Just listen again to what Jesus says in verse 13. "You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so. That's what I am." Well, it's quite clear Jesus didn't suffer from what the psychologists call a low self-esteem, did he? Or again in verse 3, as we've already said, Jesus knew the Father, who put all things under his power, that he'd come from God and was returning to God. Jesus had a massive opinion of himself. He had an extraordinary view of his personal nobility and dignity. And what I want you to understand is that humility was only possible for Jesus in the way he demonstrated here, because he had such a positive self-image. You can't be truly humble unless you have a secure sense of your own identity. The reason the world finds humility unattractive is because it doesn't understand that. The world associates humility so often with that cringing, snivelling attitude of a scared dog with its tail between its legs that we spoke of earlier. The world thinks there's something undignified about humility because it confuses humility with servility. It confuses meekness with weakness. The only way the world knows for a person to feel they have dignity is by self-assertion. Forcing other people to think highly of you. Self-esteem in our world today is built out of competition, out of rivalry, isn't it? The things we do, the status we gain, the goals we achieve, the elections we win, the examinations we pass, if we're lucky. It's all about doing things, achieving things, winning things. But no, you see, that's a fundamental error. Our human dignity does not consist in what we do, but in who we are. Made in God's image. Loved by God. That dignity is inalienable. Jesus exemplifies it here. He knew who he was. And because he knew who he was, he could take the role of a slave without feeling threatened by that role, without feeling his ego was under attack, without needing any of that defensiveness we always clothe ourselves in whenever our ego is attacked. He didn't lose his essential dignity, you see, as he knelt at the feet of his disciples and washed them. He was still their Lord. Very important we get this straight. It's because he knew who he was able to be humble without shame, to be a servant without being servile. Humility will only be possible for us, you know, on a similar basis. We must know ourselves to be secure in the privilege and dignity of being children of God. We must know that whatever our outer condition may be, our inner condition is noble and destined for glory. We must know that our dignity lies not in what I force other people to think of me, but in what God, my Maker, declares me to be. Once I realize that, I am freed from the necessity of aggression and self-assertion as a means of protecting my ego. I am freed to be humble. Only the absolutely secure person can ever afford to take the risk of real humility. So don't mistake it for an inferiority complex. That brings me to the second lesson I want you to learn. The necessity of humility if you want to go to heaven. Look again at those slightly more opaque verses from verse 6 to 9. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, Lord, are you going to wash my feet? Jesus replied, you do not realize now what I'm doing. Later you'll understand. No, Satan, you shall never wash my feet. Jesus answered, unless I wash you, you have no part with me. I suppose Peter's protest is superficially laudable, isn't it? The disciple is shocked to see his master groveling at his feet. It doesn't befit the esteem in which Peter held Jesus. You, he says, you wash my feet. The pronouns are very emphatic. But Jesus is just as emphatic in his rebuke. You don't realize now what I'm doing. You'll understand later. How often, that is true, of course, incidentally. How often our rash indignation at God's dealings with us ought to be muted. There are many experiences in our lives we may resent bitterly at the time they happen, which we would value on maturer reflection. It's a general point Jesus is making. But patience, you see, was never Peter's strong point. No, he says. What a bold man to say that to Jesus. No. You shall never, again, double negative, very emphatic, you shall never wash my feet. No. You shall never, again, double negative, very emphatic, you shall never wash my feet. For all its apparent modesty, you see, this is not humility on Peter's part at all, is it? This is inverted pride. This is the pride which is willing to admire greatness, but not to be patronized by it. This is the pride that is willing to bathe in Jesus' reflected glory, but not to accept the demeaning embarrassment of his charity. Jesus' response this time is an uncompromising warning. Unless I wash you, you have no part with me. Is that not a frightening thing? No share in my inheritance. That's what it means. No share in heaven. That's what he's implying. No part with me. Now, of course, those who interpret these words against this sacramentalist background use this text to defend the view of baptismal regeneration, that baptism is necessary to salvation. Unless I wash you, you have no part with me. It's obvious, isn't it? But that's a proposition which couldn't possibly be defended from the general tenor of the New Testament, and as we've already said, the sacraments are not what is in mind here. Yet Jesus is profoundly disturbed by the reluctance of Peter to receive this outward sign of his dying love. That must be. It's as if he's saying, you see, of course it's humiliating, Peter, for you to watch me wash your feet in this way. But it will be even more humiliating for you, Peter, when you have to watch me hanging on the cross for you tomorrow. If you can't cope with this, how are you ever going to cope with that? Don't you realize, Peter, if you're going to be a participant in my heavenly kingdom, it necessarily involves you in being willing to let me humble myself on your account. Unless you're prepared for such a humiliation on my part, you cannot share my inheritance. You can have no part. Am I not speaking the truth when I say there are an awful lot of Peters in this world who respond just the same? Oh yes, if we could earn our ticket to heaven by our moral achievements or by our charitable activities, we would do it. There are plenty of people in this town, if you told them, now what you have to do is this, 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 and this, and this, and then you can be sure you're going to heaven, they'd be doing it, you'd be queued at the door. If we told them, you pay me £500 and I guarantee you a ticket to heaven, I'd be the richest man in the kingdom. But because we have to face them in the words of the gospel, kneel by that cross and watch the Son of God die for you, nobody wants it. Now his inheritance is only for those humble enough to let Christ cleanse them with his most precious blood. There can be no heaven for those who are too proud to let Jesus wash their feet. Typically, of course, Peter then goes right over the top, doesn't he? Then, Lord, he replies, not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well. Now, as again, those who are inclined to make too much of the sacraments often read rather more into this verse once again. Peter, in his misplaced zeal, seeks baptism by full immersion. Jesus' reply insists that for the truly saved person, a partial sprinkling is sacramentally effective. And the sacramentalists have great fun with verse 10, too. A person who has had a bath needs only to wash his feet. His whole body is clean. And you are clean, and not every one of you. Catholic commentators often like to read into this a reference to the confessional. Once you're baptized, what? A Christian doesn't need to be baptized again, but simply to participate in the regular feet-washing sacraments of the Church, namely penance and the Mass. Now, as I say, that sort of interpretation seems to me utterly forced, because this feet-washing, as we've already seen, is a symbol not of the sacramental ministry of the Church, but of the saving death of Jesus, of which, of course, those sacraments ought themselves to be regarded as symbols. So the water with which he washed his disciples' feet was a picture of his blood that would cleanse their hearts, not of baptism or sprinkling, still less of priestly absolution. By far, then, the easiest way to understand these verses is to take them as a comment on the comparative unimportance of outward sacramental signs compared to the importance of inward heart reality. A person who's had a bath needs only to wash his feet, Jesus is saying. In other words, there are some people who enjoy the fundamental status of being acceptable in God's sight. They are forgiven their sins. They are justified by faith. They are sanctified by the Spirit. They have been washed. They are clean, radically, absolutely, finally. Nothing needs to be added to that. For such people, the outward sign of foot washing is quite enough to affirm their fundamental identity as the children of God and dispel perhaps any minor defilements that have rubbed off them on them as they've journeyed through the world. The important thing is to have had the bath, the full work, to have been the object of my atoning blood. But the implication is clear, isn't it? In the absence of that fundamental and primary cleansing, sacramental signs, rituals, outward observances and ceremonies, even when they're performed by the hand of Christ himself, don't really achieve very much. Indeed, in the case of some, they can be nothing but a hypocritical farce. And there was one person there in that upper room who proved that conclusively. You are clean, but not every one of you. For he knew who was going to betray him. That was why he said, not everyone was clean. I think it's immensely significant that Judas was still with the disciples at this point in the narrative. Jesus washed the feet of his own betrayer that night, and he washed them knowingly. So far from endorsing our exaggerated view of the sacrament, these verses actually serve as a solemn warning at the inadequacy of any such ritual, don't they? We can come to the table of the Lord and yet be a traitor. We can have Jesus wash our feet and yet be a Judas. A sacrament, I suppose, may validly confirm the salvation of the saved when it's received by faith. But it can't confer salvation on an unsaved person. No matter who does it, which church performs it, even if it's done by Jesus himself. If we are inwardly unclean, there is no outward act that can do us any good at all. So it's no wonder Paul advised the Corinthians, examine yourself before you come to the Lord's table. If we eat and drink in an unworthy fashion, then like Judas, we eat and drink judgment upon ourselves. Here is our second lesson. Beware of pride. Beware of the pride that refuses to let Jesus do what he must do if we must be saved. Cleanse us. Peter was in danger, real danger, when he gave that emphatic negative back to his master. No, you shall never wash my feet. If he had been sustained in that opinion, the awful words of Jesus would have proven true. You have no part in me. Fortunately for Peter, he learned his lesson. The tragedy of Judas, as we shall see next week, is that he did not. But I said there were three lessons. Let me come to the last. A lesson about the nature of humility, don't confuse it with an inferiority complex. A lesson about the necessity of humility. You cannot be saved without it. But finally, a very important lesson drawn from this model of humility Jesus set for those of us who are called in any respect whatsoever to be Christian leaders. Look again at that closing paragraph of our passage. You call me teacher and Lord, rightly so, but that is what I am. Now I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet. You also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done. I tell you the truth. No servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now I think there's a real stroke of genius about John's narrative here, you see. He knows as well as we do the famous words Jesus had spoken at the Last Supper, which everybody associated with this particular moment in his life, just before Judas goes out, before he passes the sop from the table. They were solemnly pronounced over the bread and wine by Christian pastors of John's day, just as they are today. This do in remembrance of me. But as they say, I have a suspicion that by the end of the first century, those words were already in danger of becoming empty cant. Liturgical formality, which nobody really thought about anymore. What does it really mean to take bread and break it in remembrance of Christ? So John here doesn't even mention the bread and wine. And instead of those famous words, this do in remembrance of me, we find similar, but far less hackneyed words from the lips of Christ. This do, he says, as I have done. Am I reading too much into it to say John wants us to understand there that sharing in bread and wine around the table of the Lord is no more than a perfunctory rite unless we are moved by the sight of those broken and poured out elements to give our lives in the sacrificial service of others as Jesus our Master on the cross. That's how he wants to be remembered most of all. Not in our ecclesiastical cant, but in our serving of one another. This do as I have done. And this is an immensely and particularly important lesson for those of us, as I say, who are called to leadership in the church. That's whom Jesus is preeminently talking to in the immediate context here, isn't he? 12 men who would shortly become apostles. Leaders of the infant church. In fact, he uses the word apostle here, though it's hidden in our translation. Apostle is the Greek word that lies behind that word messenger in verse 16. And I'm sure John uses it with some thought. Jesus is commending to these men here the leadership model he would have them adopt as apostles, leaders of his church. As we've already said, the world so often assumes the way to feel you're important, to exert leadership, to be an influence, is to dominate other people, to give them orders, to boss them about. And of course, when these disciples of his rivaled one another for rank and power in the kingdom, they were simply emulating that pagan model. They were trying to be leaders the way the world had leaders. Self-assertive, self-aggrandizing. Jesus is showing them a better way. A way that proceeds not by dominating others, but by serving them. I have washed your feet. You also should wash one another's feet. No servant is greater than his master. Fundamentally, then, Jesus is telling us here that what he looks for when he looks for leaders in the church, or come to that in the Christian Union, is not for great organizers, or brilliant intellectuals, or heroic people who everybody else looks up to. Fundamentally, what he's looking for are people who know how to be servants. People who have learned from Christ the greatness of humility. No single lesson any of us can learn will more alter our understanding or our approach to what it means to be a leader than that. Humility changes the way we seek leadership. If we are wise, we will be very suspicious of the pushy types who are always volunteering themselves for office. The best leaders will often be those who are reluctant to accept positions of authority, precisely because they are meek and lowly in heart. Humility will change the way we accept leadership too. We will not feel piqued and peeved when others are elected in our place. We will not object to playing second fiddle. We will not be found forever whining about our rights or plotting rebellion among the malcontents. Like John the Baptist, we will be content to say of our colleagues, he must increase, but I must decrease. And feel no shame or failure in that admission. But supremely, humility will change the way we exert leadership. You know as well as I do, all too often the church has suffered from the oppression, the tyranny of those who display an authoritarian style of ministry. Bossing people around, turning the Christian ministry into their own ego trip, projecting their personality and their glory whenever they get the chance to do so. You've seen it. It is not Jesus' way. It is not Jesus' way. He took the form of a servant. How much more then ought we, who are no more than servants anywhere, to be ready to adopt such a role among the people of God? There's nothing more moving on earth than a Christian leader who has learnt that lesson. In his commentary, F.F. Bruce tells the story of a man called Robert Cleaver Chapman, a great saint of Barnstable. He was an aristocrat by birth and had high office in the church. But it was his regular practice, whenever he had guests in his home, to personally clean their shoes for them. His explanation was, in former days they washed the saint's feet. I do the nearest thing I can. I polish their boots. Little wonder that man had such a great impact on the people he led. I'll give you another example I'm even more personally acquainted with. This week I was in Reading speaking at a conference, and I stayed with a friend of mine from Africa who's now living there. And he reminded me of the thing which as a young boy made the first impact for the gospel on his life. He was living in Ghana. He had just gone to a boarding school for the first time, 11 years old. You can just imagine how unsettled and insecure he felt. Away from the family. With just the first few days of term, he felt completely at sea. After the Sunday evening chapel, it was announced there was going to be a squash in one of the common rooms. A squash, for those who don't know it, was the old word people used to use for a kind of Christian gathering of an informal sort, where everybody squeezes into a room that is really too small and sings choruses. He didn't know what a squash was, and he couldn't find the common room. So by the time he got there, everything was already proceeding. The room was packed. There was nowhere to sit. He stood by the door, looking extremely uncomfortable and worrying about what he should do this little first year. There at the front was the headmaster, sitting on one of the few available seats. Without even thinking about it, this Christian headmaster got up and sat down on the floor so that this young first year could have a seat. I don't suppose that headmaster even thought about what he was doing. I don't suppose it occurred to him for one moment he was making some mega gesture. But that made such a huge impact on that young 11-year-old African boy, who was a major factor in directing him towards Jesus Christ. We can never tell, you know, the impact, the influence we may have if we follow the model of Jesus' leadership. After all, think about him. Did he ever win an election? Did he ever sit on a throne? Did he ever command an army? The only crown he ever had was made of thorns. The only palace he ever entered was as a prisoner. We follow a crucified master. A king who threatens nobody, oppresses nobody, coerces nobody. His leadership is addressed from the cross. But can you tell me a person in the whole history of the world who has influenced men and women more? Influence you more. Learn the lesson of humility. Beware selfish ambition. Beware vain glory. Beware the seduction of power. Humility is vital if you want to get to heaven. Humility is vital if you want to be great in the kingdom of heaven. For in the kingdom of heaven, there's a very paradoxical geography. Wherever you look, the way up is down. Let's pray together. A few moments of quiet. Humility is not something we can achieve, as we said right at the beginning. No amount of effort is going to make us what Jesus wants us to be in this respect. But if we meditate on his cross, if we focus our minds as he did around service to God and to others, if we are content to be obedient, whatever the cost, then maybe humility will just happen to us as it happened to him, kind of byproduct.